I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we take a closer look at the dictionary. What's the process for words to be included in a dictionary? Are words ever removed? What insight can dictionaries give us about society and our history? Steve Klein-Idler is the executive editor for the American Heritage Dictionary. He joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you for having me on your program.
Sure. This past year, you added more than 400 new words to the 2016 edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. So how do you compile lists of the words to be considered for inclusion?
There's several processes involved. In terms of compiling the lists that we use to winnow down, we get emails from the general public. Our consultants are telling us what words in the areas that they're working on are new or should have been there all along that we should add. And the editorial staff ourselves, we are paying attention to the world around us, looking at the news, reading voraciously, that sort of thing, keeping an eye out for new words and novel uses of existing words. Mm-hmm. There's a very large document that we have that we add to frequently and review from time to time, and that becomes the basis of the words that we decide to add in at any given time. There's a couple types of words that some go in automatically just by virtue of people in charge saying these are the words. A good example of that is this year, four new chemical elements were synthesized. Mm-hmm. They were just finalized last week, so they're going in the next batch. But elements 113, 115, 117, and 118 are now not in the same order: oganessen, tennessine, nihonium, and muscovium. The people who named them, they said, this is what they are. That's mm-hmm. That's all you need. That, of course, is the minority of words. With other words, we see how widespread they are. At the American Heritage Dictionary, we tend to not put them in unless we think they're going to have staying power and stick around. If we think a word might be ephemeral, we might wait a year or two and see if it sticks around. When it's used widespread in a variety of situations, and as we talk about some of the new words that we've added this year, I can give specific examples of like, oh, we added it because of this reason or that reason.
So what are some of this year's new words?
I've divided them into some chunks. For example, everyone likes to talk about food, and every year I make sure there are new food words to talk about because it's something that most people can heartily jump into. It's a connection they have with something they do every day, that is eat. And there are interesting things you can say about the processes as to how we add words. So a couple of these, maki, for example, which is a type of rolled sushi. We added that. It's from the Japanese makasushi. Maki is from a Japanese word meaning to roll. And as you see more this type of sushi spread across the country, you know, you're going to find it in Kansas just as much as you are in New York City. And you will see non-sushi restaurants, do takes on little types of rolls, just like you can have a restaurant that's not a Mexican restaurant do things with burritos. You see these rolled rice dishes in other restaurants as well. And it's widespread enough and common enough. And more importantly, when people refer to it, when you see it written about in newspapers and the like, when a word first comes in, often a newspaper article or a blog post or whatever will define the word. They'll talk about this item and then tell the reader what it means. At that point, when they stop telling the reader what it means and they assume that the reader will know what it means, that's one indication that the word has crossed that little boundary and is now assumed to be a word that people understand and comprehend. And that's another sign that it's probably time to enter it.
Yeah. Glamping is a new word this year, defined as camping in glamorous or luxurious conditions. Now, this might fall into the is that word really necessary category for a number of people. Do you remember any discussion about this word in the review process?
Well, this goes back to what I was saying about ephemerality. Glamping has been around for quite a while, and when it first entered our radar, my initial response is, "Oh, this will never last." it sounds like it's one of those words that is really big, has a really quick trajectory up, and then it flames out to be forgotten. And most words of this kind do follow that pattern. This one didn't. It only got more and more popular over time. You will see articles about this in a wide array of different news sources. And on top of that, there is a extremely large commercial activity, this kind of like cottage industry devoted to people who go glamping. So you will see reference to it on all types of mercantile sites, you know, trying to get you to buy their fancy products for when you go glamping and whatnot. It has only gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Last year when we came around again, the editors, we realized, yeah, it's probably going to stick around and it's time. So it's a good example of something that, you know, could have been added several years ago, but, you know, we didn't really think it was going to stick around, and it did. So in it goes.
So now it is. So what's the process then for the word to be included in the new edition?
Well, it depends on the kind of word. Oh, and if you're talking about the actual process, once we decide it goes in, one of the editors, or if it's a consultant who has said, oh, this word should go in, someone will write an initial draft definition based on the usage from a large number of citations. Obviously, in some cases, again, with the chemical elements, it pretty much is what it is. And in that case, our consultant will just check into half-lives and other aspects about the chemical element that distinguishes it from other elements. But for general words, you want to see how people are actually using it. And you, from all of these citations, you draft a definition. And then that goes to a review editor. If I draft a definition, one of the other editors will look at it, and vice versa. Sometimes it's pretty straightforward. Other times it requires a few rounds of revision. And in some cases, it requires then going back to the consultant or other consultants and saying, could you look at this? We have questions about this. How does it fit together? Sometimes it falls together very quickly and it's pretty straightforward. Sometimes it can take time.
Yeah. Like the glamping. Well, it's funny because how many times you hear from people who go, wait a minute, I invented that word.
You will get occasionally letters or emails from people claiming to coin a term. Invariably, you can find evidence that it existed long before that. And especially with nowadays when people throw two words together, when something happens in the news or someone makes a cute play on words, you will see on Twitter, for example, this new concept being thought up independently by hundreds or thousands of people, depending on how obvious it is. So there's a lot of that going on. But, again, I keep using chemical elements because it provides such a good hook. In the case of Oganessen, it was named after a scientist named Yuri Oganessen. I forget exactly how his last name, but it begins with Oganessen. And the people who synthesize the element have the ability to propose a name for it, and they did so to honor the scientist. So there are times where people actually do get to choose what they call a word, in other cases it just catches on.
So tell us more about the American Heritage Usage Panel.
Yes. The American Heritage Usage Panel, American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel, has been in existence since the 60s. It is a group of about 170 linguists and writers and playwrights and poets and authors and journalists and people who construct crossword puzzles. Mm-hmm. People who deal with words, with the language as part of their day-to-day career. It's chaired by the linguist Steven Pinker, and we periodically poll them. We'll send them out a ballot with usage questions, and we'll ask them whether a certain usage is to them acceptable or unacceptable, and if there's a wide number of choices, you know, which choice they might prefer. And these form the basis of our usage notes. So where our definitions will describe how people actually use the word in question. As we all know, there are certain usage issues that don't cut the mustard, mm-hmm. as it were. And in those cases, we'll pull the panel, and then we can give the user of the dictionary information about, well, you know, this is how it's used, but this is how it's perceived. And depending on who you're speaking to, what your audience is, how much you care or don't care about the rules. If this usage issue is something that bothers you or might bother your audience, here's what the usage panel has to say about it. And you can use the results of the ballot to determine whether or not you choose to use a certain locution, whether you choose to boldly split your infinitives, that sort of thing.
Mm. We took a look at your usage panel list and found some names NPR listeners are probably familiar with. Frank DeFord, Maureen Corrigan, Leanne Hansen, David Sedaris, Will Shortz, Susan Stamberg. So how do you choose panelists? You mentioned they work in the business, but there's a lot of more than 100 and something people you could choose. So how do you choose and how much influence do they have on the final version of the dictionary?
That is correct. And if your listeners want to see the full list, if they go to ahdictionary.com, which is our online dictionary, on the left-hand side, there's a box about the usage panel. And if you click on that, it'll bring up the full list and what their affiliations are. I've been with the American Heritage Dictionary for 20 years now, and every year the editors come up with a list of people that we would like to consider, and we run that through the chair, which I mentioned is currently Steven Pinker. Prior to him, about 10 years ago, it was Jeffrey Numberg, and before that it was Edwin Newman. I believe those are the only three who have ever been a chair. And we want to get a wide array of people. Originally, if you look at the lists from the 60s, there's a concentration of people on the East Coast, specifically D.C., Boston, New York, not exclusively, but pretty heavily weighted. So in the past several decades, there's been a move to involve more people from other parts of the country. It had been more heavily weighted towards men over women, and in the past several decades, again, by each year asking more women than men, the gender ratio is pretty close to 50-50 right now. We are looking at a array of not just pundits, not just teachers. So we've expanded to include playwrights, poets, visual artists. Jenny Holzer, for example, who her art involves you know word displays, and as you mentioned, crossword puzzle constructions. We've got a couple cursive verbalists on there too, just to different takes on language. We send them a very nice email, and we offer them a free dictionary for their time, and most of them say yes. It's a fairly minimal investment, and on their end, and how they shape the dictionary is their input, their votes determines how when we take the raw data then and construct a usage note around it, and we'll use percentages, X percent thought this was good, X percent disapproves of this usage. So they help shape the usage notes in that way. And occasionally, often on the ballot, they will list items that they would like to see balloted or other usage notes. And, we take their comments into consideration, and they often end up on subsequent ballots if we haven't recently balloted them already.
Yeah. America, of course, racially and culturally diverse. So how do you ensure that the complexity of American culture and language use is represented in the dictionary?
That's a good question. Are you speaking to the dictionary itself or to the usage panel? Okay,
the dictionary itself. Yeah.
We review a wide variety of sources from coast to coast. We also our dictionary is not geared towards any specific niche group, whether it's a racial group or a work group. Like, we don't have the minutia of plumbing slang, for example. Mm-hmm. We tend to go for a broad based coverage. So there are specialty dictionaries, and they're great things. You'll find a lot of them on the internet. Because our staff is the size that it is, and because there's only so many hours in a day, we focus on words that receive wide coverage across the across the nation, and that comes from a variety of sources. We've got food words, as I mentioned, from all over the globe. That, you know, it does include words from, you know, various cultural, socioeconomic groups. We're not looking at strictly, you know, elite classist magazines. We're looking at a variety of sources. And the regional English plays an importance when it becomes nationally noticed, whether it's from African-American vernacular English or whether it's from the inland north region, the Great Lakes region, what have you. If it's a term that's exclusive to just one tiny area and doesn't go outside of that, then it won't receive as much weight as a term that is used nationally. I think a really good example of that is the word twerk, which we added a couple years ago, which to most of the population might have seemed to be a new word. But at that point, it had already been around for several decades. Before we could add it, what we needed to do was research that area of dance and music, because there was a lot of supporting vocabulary that needed to be examined, reviewed, and or added in order to support the definition at twerk. One of those is the dance and category of bounce, which is fairly regional, or was at one time fairly regional to the New Orleans area. And as twerking became more on the national radar, so too did bounce. But just adding the word twerk alone required us to add a couple senses and revise several more senses. So you can't just plop a word into the dictionary in isolation. You have to look at the semantic universe that surrounds it. And, oh, by adding this, it means we need to tweak this and add this. And we can't add this word without having this underlying structure there. So in order to do justice to the word, you've got to delve into its background and its history and make sure that you're supporting it and you're not adding it just because, you know, it's the zeitgeist. Mm. It's you're adding it because it has a significance, and you want to honor that significance by making sure that you're putting in the supporting documentation, if you will.
It's a lot more complicated than you might think. And we're talking with Steve Kleinedler. He's the executive editor for the American Heritage Dictionary. If you have questions about words in the dictionary, we'd love to hear from you. Do you still look up words in the dictionary? Do you even own a dictionary? 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are taking a look at the dictionary this morning and the process for words to be included. We're talking with Steve Kleinedler. He's the executive editor for the American Heritage Dictionary. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, here's a toughie. How do you determine acceptable pronunciation for words?
There's a couple of ways. In some cases, one listens to a lot of YouTube clips of newscasts and other things. In the old days, and by that I mean like 15, 20 years ago, when, for example, when we added a slew of pharmaceutical drugs, I personally would call up pharmaceutical companies and, ask. Without coming out, sometimes you'd come out and say, hey, I'm the pronunciation editor. How do you all pronounce this? And sometimes I would ask about a certain drug and hear how they said it, unprompted. In other cases, if there seems to be a disagreement, we'll ask the usage panel. Harass is a really good example of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to read out the whole note because it's really long. But again, mm-hmm. Your listeners can go to hdictionary.com, look up the word harass. At one point, Harris was the traditional pronunciation and widely favored. Harass was the outlier. By 1987, it was a 50-50 split. When we surveyed again in 2001, 70% preferred harass and 30% preferred Harris. And then in 2013, only 10% preferred Harris. And not only that, 35% of the panel thought Harris was an unacceptable pronunciation. Mm. That's one of the more interesting pronunciation notes that we have, and it goes into detail about how it's shifted over the decades. And this last year, we updated the note for either xenophobia or xenophobia, depending on how you want to say it. Although xenophobia is the older traditional pronunciation, xenophobia has also been around for a very long time. And as it turns out, and this rarely happens, the vast majority of the usage panelists thought both forms were totally fine. And when asked which they prefer, it was almost a 50-50 split. So with that one, you can't really go wrong. And in that case, you just want to be consistent. If you're doing a broadcast or something, you don't want to flip back and forth. Choose one and go with it.
So you do make changes then to definitions and pronunciations with new additions.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. As the result of the usage panel, we'll probably revise several dozen words each year, and then in addition to adding new words, we're also adding new senses of existing words. And on top of that, although we mentioned, there were 400 new words and senses, there were also, thousands of revisions. Each editor, in addition to random things that may cross our desks, we'll go through for example, review all the food terminology or review all the textiles or review all the mountaineering terms or, review something in clumps. And then so to our consultants, we spent over 3.5 years probably close to 4.5 years doing a biochemistry review, because up until that point, a lot of the biochemistry terms hadn't been looked at in a couple decades. And of course, things change. The beauty of having the online dictionary is that every several months we can upload all the new information. And then every time there's a printing, we incorporate as much as we possibly can onto the printed page. Obviously, it's the case that there's going to be more up-to-date information on the web, which makes the online version a nice tool to have. But we incorporate as much as we can into the print edition.
Last month, we had a discussion with Josh Katch about his book, Speaking American. It includes his vibrant maps of the U.S. showing how Americans speak. And it got us thinking about the variability of both word usage and pronunciation. So how do you factor regional differences in the words Americans use into the dictionary?
Right. Our dictionary has a good deal of regional notes, some of the material comes from similar sources to the ones that he used. The Dictionary of American Regional English, which is a very fine publication out of Madison, Wisconsin. In fact, if you haven't spoken to those editors, at some point you might want to do that, because it's a fascinating – there's a whole hour right there or more. although we don't have the maps, we do have descriptions of where these words are spoken. So, if you look up the typical things like frosting versus icing, for example, or gutters versus downspout, or, I'm from Michigan, I say boughten as a past participle, that type of thing, you'll see an indication of what region of the country that use is used in. And sometimes there will be a note accompanying the entry to go into more detail.
I just mentioned this to Josh, something he didn't have in his book was scallop versus scallop. Now, if you're here in this area of the country, you don't say scallop, you say scallop. But years ago, we looked it up, and both pronunciations were correct. I don't know if they still are, but according to the dictionary, they were both correct.
Well, that's because of regional variation. They are both correct. It just depends on what part of the country you're from. And in American dictionaries, at least, rather than using a phonetic, like the International Phonetic Alphabet, most American dictionaries uses a phonemic system, which will take into account different accents. So, just the short vowel O, as in the word P-O-T, if you're from the Great Lakes region and you say pot, all of your short O's are going to sound like that. Whereas if you're not from that area, you're going to say something more like pop. The key is keyed to your regional accent, because how someone talks when they're from another part of the country doesn't always, there's a lot of regional variation.
That's for sure.
So,
I understand you have a tattoo of a phonetic vowel chart on your back. Every tattoo has a story. What's the story with this one?
Well, originally, in the early 90s, when I was in graduate school, I got a gift certificate for a tattoo. And I'm like, what am I going to get? And I got why not why not this? I got a very simple six character, just very, it's very rudimentary, and that's on my upper shoulder blade. I've never actually had it removed. But later on, I decided to get a full-fledged, really nicely designed one that shows all of the vowels in the International Phonetic Alphabet and on the grid that represents your mouth, your oral cavity, where your tongue is when those vowel sounds are pronounced. And I went to a designer in Boston, and I said, hey, I also like subway maps, so it's a little stylized. Mm-hmm. And I got it done. Carl Zimmer, the science writer, wrote up about it in his science tattoo blog, and he ended up using it in his book Science Inc., which is a great little coffee table book of geeky science tattoos.
That's funny. Now, a dictionary could be used as a historical snapshot of our society. If you were to compare dictionaries of the past 50 years with the dictionaries of the last decade, what do you think would stand out?
I think, in all honesty, 50 years doesn't show that much change. I mean, obviously, if you're comparing across centuries, you'll start to see some change. You'll find the DNA of them is largely the same. And what's different is, I mean, obviously, there's tens of thousands of revisions we made in 2011 when that edition went out. But it's also a 2,200-page book. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of material there that stays fairly static. I think you will find an awareness of, you know, like if you look at the quotations that are used, they used to be almost strictly literary from the 1800s, 1700s. You'll find a much more robust use of examples that are taken from sources so that it's not just – you're not quoting Thackeray and Shakespeare over and over, but you're using modern-day writers in a wide variety of not just print forms but online forms. So there's a greater awareness of the world at large, I think. In terms – again, coming back to food, you know, in the 60s, we had just gone through Julia Child and this renaissance of French cuisine. And so at that point in English, a lot of French terminology was being reintroduced. And whereas now you're going to find certainly a great deal of East Asian, South Asian, Latin American – I mean just food influences coming from – all across the world, a greater awareness of those. And at least in our dictionary, our etymologist, but all of our etymologists have worked under the original etymologist back in the 60s, who was at Harvard, and the detail to which they go into the history of a word, whether it's going to either, you know, Proto-Indo-European, Proto-Semitic, early Middle Chinese, our current etymologist knows so many languages and has access to so many. I mean, he speaks well over a dozen. He's familiar with about three dozen. He's currently in Turkey teaching. One of the reasons he went there was to study Kurmanji, which is a language spoken in Southeast Turkey. And so, you know, with our etymologists' skills, they are able to really delve into the history of a word, you know, like, yeah, this came from Akkadian, this mm-hmm. came from Mon Khmer. You know, it's fascinating. So you'll see great, at least in our dictionary, you'll see greater depth as to the history of a word.
Yeah, the origin of words and phrases is always interesting, and I think people are always curious about that. So are these origins included in most of the dictionary entries or just some of them?
In most of them, unless it's a transparent compound, you know, like if you've got a prefix being added to a word, it may not have it. Something like eye patch or something, which is, you know, eye plus patch. But most of them, yes, especially, yeah. Yes, it's just part of the process of defining a word. It goes through, you know, the pronunciation is added and an etymology is added. So mm-hmm. the etymologist looks at everything that we add.
Now, are phrases or sayings ever included?
There are idioms. The American Heritage Dictionary has a dictionary of idioms, which is more expansive, but very, you know, your kick the buckets, mm-hmm. that sort of thing are going to be included.
The usage of the pronoun they might be a good example of some changes in our society that are becoming apparent in our usage of language. Some people who don't identify as either male or female have begun to use the pronoun they to identify themselves. So how do your panels respond to this usage?
Right. This is a really good word to look at to discuss this sort of change. There's a few things going on with they. The first being the use of singular they. Everyone took their hat and left, which is a very old part of English. It's been around for centuries, even though people have been complaining about it for not quite as many centuries. And if your listeners look up the word they, they'll see a very long usage note about that. But that's only part of the story. In addition to that aspect of singular they, we also added a new sense for they, used as a singular personal pronoun for someone who does not identify as either male or female. And we go into detail in the note. And the copy of the note that you have in your materials is actually a condensation of the full note. It's a very long note. And so when we added that sense and pulled the panel on that, And that part reads, the recent use of singular they for a known person who identifies as neither male nor female remains controversial. As of 2015, only 27% of the panelists accepted the sentence, Scout was born male, but now they do not identify as either traditional gender. However, there's a generational shift there. When we looked at the ages of the respondents, the approval rate was just 4% among panelists before 1945, and it was 40% among panelists born after 1945. So there you see a trajectory to this use that we thought was very interesting and worth reporting on. Yeah. So the fact of the matter is, and this is something that we spent a lot of time researching, you know, looking around for uses of this sort of they, individuals who identify through this pronoun. And when you look for it, you can find a great deal. We certainly found enough usage of it to warrant its inclusion.
Yeah. Americans love word games such as Scrabble. And I imagine you're a word lover. You must be playing some word games. What role do dictionaries play in those games?
Well, I mean, they do because the role they play is when people challenge other words. I'm decent at Scrabble. I mean, I'm not bad, but I'm not a Scrabble master, mostly because the people who excel at Scrabble have spent an insane amount of time memorizing word lists. The author Stefan Fatsis has written a book called Word Freak, which is about competitive Scrabble competitions, and he goes into great detail about how these competitions work. And there are just lists and lists of alphabetized sequences of seven letters that you memorize, and then you remember what words come from that sequence of seven letters. So for someone who can easily memorize a large amount of information like that, they're definitely at an advantage. Mm-hmm. And these are the people that you tend to see win the Scrabble competitions. Crossword puzzles is a different set of I want to use my words carefully here, of passion. Yeah. My colleague Ben Zimmer covers the crossword competitions quite nicely. And, you know, that takes a different kind of mental approach and mental agility to it too. Where I excel at are the cryptograms, the things you'll find in the books where they do letter substitutions. Even the challenger ones, it's like I'll see I can look at them and abstract away the patterns, and just I surprise myself at how quickly I'm often able to do them just by looking at letter frequencies and stuff. So I guess that's my secret power when it comes to puzzles.
Yeah. Well, and every year the Oxford Dictionary chooses the word of the year, and this year's choice was post-truth. In the past, vape and selfie received the honor, both of which the autocorrect in my word processing program flagged as not in the dictionary. Does the American Heritage Dictionary choose a word of the year?
No, we haven't traditionally. back, the American Dialect Society started choosing words of the year in 1990. Webster's New World, sometime before that, when it became a thing that a lot of people were doing, the then executive editor decided, you know, there was just so many people were doing it, it would just get lost in the shuffle. So what we focus on is exactly what I'm doing here, rather than talk about one word which may or may not have staying power. We do an end of the year roundup where we talk about all the different things that we've added. Just something different, and it's also it gives me something more substantial to talk about.
Processes. Yeah. Yes. So now there are a number of different dictionaries: Merriam's, Oxford, American Heritage, and of course the dictionary in our word processing program. So how do these dictionaries differ?
Well, it's a very small world. I'm very close friends with most of the editors at most of my competitors. We all belong to an organization called the Dictionary Society of North America, which I'm currently the vice president of. So it's, you know, we're all colleagues. They differ in there are stylistic differences. Merriam-Webster, for example, in their etymologies will state what year a word is first attested in English. We're more likely to take it back to Proto-European and discuss its connections with other words that come from those roots. Neither approach is better than the other. They're just two different approaches. Mm-hmm. Wise editors, copy editors don't have just one dictionary on their desk. They have several, all of the main ones for sure. And, you know, those dictionaries that are embedded on your phones ultimately are licensed from one of us. Dictionary.com currently has an editorial staff as well, so in all cases there are trained lexicographers, you know, researching this information and adding the information. So it's in some cases it's like different brands of toothpaste put out by different.
They all get the job done, right?
Yeah. We all get the job done. And again, I think, you know, it makes sense to own multiple dictionaries or style guides, too, whether, you know, you use MLA or Chicago or what have you.
Now, in the newsroom, we were discussing it wasn't long ago that every household had at least one hardbound dictionary. Pre-internet. Is that a word? Pre-internet? It was how we learned the correct spelling and definition of words. Now most people just Google it. So do you know if the sales of bound dictionaries has remained consistent or declined in the age of the internet?
I think everyone would be very open about the fact that obviously sales of bound dictionaries have declined in the past 20 years. I mean, there's no disputing it. If you look at every single company's staff, they've either gone out of business or they've been greatly reduced. Random House was the first to let its dictionary go in about 1999. Others have followed, and those of us that remain, the staffs are not what they were. That said, there is still... And it surprises me, and I'm very happy. It has leveled off, A, which is good, but B, in our case at least, our juvenile dictionaries still sell incredibly strongly. We have a line of student dictionaries, children dictionaries. We significantly revise and refresh them every 3 years because in that market you have to, and they're very well acclaimed, and the sales on those are, although they may be slightly down from 20 years ago, it's nowhere near the same percentage drop as there are with adult dictionaries, and they prove to be consistent sellers. Now, is it the parents and the grandparents buying it for the children? Is it now the grandparents? That remains to be seen. And 50, 60 years from now, the bottom could fall out of that too. But for now, it's heartening to see how well juvenile dictionaries sell. And the adult ones still sell, not at the level that they used to, but there still is very strong interest by, and I think there will always be that, the percentages won't be as high as they used to be, but there is definitely a dedicated portion of the population which has great overlap.
Exactly,
and there's great overlap with public radio audiences, I believe. So that's great. And then the electronic versions augment it well. I mean, I use both online
And I do, too. And we have to leave it there. Stephen Klein-Edler is the executive editor for the American Heritage Dictionary. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Joined us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Coming up after a quick break, how music can help unlock an important truth about how the brain processes music and language.